This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The January 6th committee has laid bare, in withering detail, Donald Trump's attempt to overturn a free and fair election. But Trump had been showing his contempt for the democratic process all along. He made headlines again and again, praising strongmen like Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines. And Trump's admiration for Vladimir Putin, a genius, he recently called Putin, often embarrassed Republicans. But a much wider group of conservatives has come to admire another autocrat from the former Soviet bloc, a leader who has done everything in his power to shut down free media and keep immigrants out of his country.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to have with us the Prime Minister of Hungary. And Viktor Orban has done a tremendous job in so many different ways. Highly respected, respected all over Europe. Probably like me, a little bit controversial, but that's okay. That's okay. You've done a good job and you've kept your country safe.
Many have called Viktor Orban a despot, an authoritarian who has changed Hungary's constitution several times now in order to get his way. But there was Orban with Donald Trump in the White House in 2019.
So many changes are going on and we have some similar approaches. And I would like to express that we are proud to stand together with the United States on fighting against illegal migration, on terrorism, and to protect and help the Christian communities all around the world.
As with so much in politics these days, what once seemed startling is now a commonplace.
Hey, it's Tucker Carlson. Greetings to Hungarian CPAC. I can't believe you're in Budapest and I am not. What a wonderful country.
Last month, the Conservative Political Action Conference, one of America's most significant political gatherings, went to Budapest.
And you know why? You can tell it's a wonderful country. Because the people who have turned our country into a much less good place are hysterical when you point it out. The last thing they want is any kind of signpost to a better way, and Hungary certainly provides that.
A free, but you've got to ask, what do conservatives see when they look at Orban's Hungary? If that country is some sort of signpost, in what direction is it pointing? That's the question that made Andrew Marantz fly to Budapest and report on the CPAC Hungary Convention. Andrew, welcome back. You've been covering the right for a long time for the magazine. What was your first thought when you heard that Hungary, of all places, was going to host a CPAC event?
Honestly, I kind of thought it was a joke, maybe. It's just sort of so on the nose. The idea that this, you know, you don't have to follow this very closely to know that Hungary is like a pretty authoritarian place. And obviously, a lot of people have worried for a few years now that the Republican Party is becoming more kind of ambivalent about certain bedrock norms of American democracy. So to openly state we're going to go to this semi-authoritarian country, it just seemed kind of, I thought it was maybe a troll or something, but it was very real.
You've covered CPAC events in America before. How was covering CPAC in Hungary any different? Was it easy to get in, for example?
It was not. I mean, the sort of basic free press instinct that American conservatives have, that even if you're my so-called enemy in the culture war, it's not really a question that I'm going to let you cover my event. That assumption did not exist in Hungary. Actually, by the time I got to Hungary, I still didn't have a press pass. And this was kind of parallel to what I was hearing a lot of people on the ground saying, which was a lot of things in places like Hungary operate by what I heard people call bureaucratic gaslighting, right? So they'll tell you, yes, of course, we'd love to have you come. But then they keep saying, I'm sorry, there's not enough room. Maybe next time. And that was what kept happening to me. So eventually my requests were denied. And there was essentially no recourse. They said, you know, it's a private event and we don't want you to attend.
But in the end, you found your way in.
Yeah, I found a way. You know, I actually had someone pass me a badge and just sort of walked in that way. So, and then it sort of seemed like by the time I was in there, it would have been too embarrassing to kick me out. So they kind of said, oh, welcome, here you are.
Is this the event? Where? Which way is the speaker? Oh, here, okay, thank you.
Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, my dear American friends and conservatives from all around the world who have gathered here today, a very warm welcome.
So at the big opening event, Viktor Orban gave the keynote speech, and I think most people only really became familiar with Orban in the last 5 years. We know that Donald Trump was a big fan. But who is Viktor Orban? How did he come to power in Hungary?
Well, initially, when he was first elected in 1998, he was sort of a champion of liberal democracy in the region. Bill Clinton had him to the White House and said, this is a very exciting, you know, champion of open society. He actually studied at Oxford on a Soros scholarship. Then he lost in 2002, and it sort of apparently shattered him, and he vowed to just do whatever it took to never lose power again. And in his case, what that meant was returning in 2010, setting up a more and more semi-autocratic system and turning, in his words, against liberal democracy and toward what he calls illiberal democracy.
What's changed in Hungary since Orban took power?
So one of the interesting and kind of shocking things about this is that you could go to Hungary and actually never know that people think of it as an authoritarian place. You're not going to see gulags. You're not going to see people, you know, hauled off by secret police on a daily basis. There are universities in Hungary. Now, if you pay attention to the fine print, you know that the main independent university in Hungary was forced out and is now in exile in Vienna. Other universities are under the subtle control of some of Orban's political allies. There are still courts, but if you pay close attention, the independence of the judiciary has been chipped away at over the years. There is media that runs critical stuff about Orban, but they might find that their advertising revenue gets squeezed or that their ownership changes to people who are more in favor of the regime. You can be gay in Hungary, but you can't get married or you can't adopt children. And the Hungarian government says these are popular policies and we don't care if other countries don't like it. So their claim always is we have our democratic mandate and we're using it. There's nothing illegal about what we're doing. You just don't like the result.
But what about that mandate? How big have Orban's electoral victories been exactly? And given the way you talk about how he's consolidated power, how legitimate are those elections? How much do they reflect the real will of the Hungarian people?
In the last election, he got about half of the popular vote, a little more, and they ended up with more than two-thirds of the seats in parliament, which is a supermajority that allows them to amend the constitution. He also has a kind of informal control over the media that makes it almost impossible if you're a normal Hungarian to find the opposition's message unless you go looking for it. So yes, people are voting for him, and yes, he's popular, especially in rural areas and things like that. But, you know, he's doing a lot to make sure that the opposition can't get a foothold. That, again, is not technically illegal, but it's not exactly a level playing field.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Orbán's keynote speech.
How can I pitch in? How can I contribute to this meeting today? Well, perhaps if I told you how we won. How we defeated first the communist system, and then how we defeated the liberals, and just most recently, how we defeated the unified troops of the international liberal left at the elections. So I will tell you how we defeated them once, twice, third, fourth, fifth time, and how we're going to defeat them again. As they say at the football pitch, more, the sky's the limit.
It sounds kind of Trumpian.
Oh, very, yeah. Steve Bannon famously called Orbán Trump before Trump. And now it sort of seems like they're looking to him as a Trump after Trump. What would a more diligent, patient, frankly, smarter, more energetic version of that look like? And Orbán provides...
Well, what did it sound like? What did Orbán give the CPAC audience in terms of a game plan for defeating liberalism?
He was pretty clear. He said, you need your own media. You need to control the universities, which he's done. His main thing is sort of what he calls national sovereignty, which means essentially don't let international bureaucrats tell you what to do when it comes to, you know, respecting human rights at the border or respecting gay rights or any of that stuff. Do what you want to do as a country, which in Hungary's case means don't let same-sex couples adopt, don't allow asylum seekers to come seek asylum in your country. And whenever he's called on this, he says, well, this is my democratic mandate. Who are you to tell me what to do?
Now, what were you seeing on the floor of the convention?
It was much quieter than the one in Orlando. It wasn't the three-ring circus of triggering the libs. It was much more, you know, formally dressed people handing out, you know, thick, glossy brochures and things. But there were a few signs of the kind of more circusy element of politics where they would get into, you know, culture war issues, which, frankly, they, I think, have learned from the Americans how to do.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, very great stuff.
Okay, good.
It's, you know, it says, let's go, Brandon.
Yes, of course, yes.
That's great. There is this Never Trust the Left.
Good, thank you.
And there is this one, which shows the Prime Minister, Viktor Orban.
Ah, gatekeeper of the West.
Who is the gatekeeper of the West.
Very nice, thank you.
So, yes, you're welcome. We also have great books.
Who was there from the American side? Were there a lot of big names from the far right and the conservative, most conservative wing of the Republican Party?
Yeah, well, it was actually kind of a big tent. I mean, Candace Owens was there, the very fiery YouTube culture warrior. She was 8 months pregnant. She was there with her husband, who is the CEO of Parler, which is a kind of free speech absolutist social network. But you also had, you know, Rick Santorum was there, the former Pennsylvania senator. You had people from Project Veritas. You had people from... immigration think tanks. Trump gave a, you know, 1 minute address.
How was that short video received by the Hungarians and the Americans in the audience?
Oh, they loved it. I mean, it was, you know, he didn't have a lot of specifics to say. He basically said Orban's a great guy.
Hungary. We are very close, as you know, all of us, to Viktor Orban. He's a great leader, a great gentleman, and he just had a very big election result. I was very honored to have endorsed him. A little unusual endorsement.
You know, a lot of this is a kind of PR campaign for Orban, right? He wants to be a big player. And so if you have big names, you know, touting you, then you're a big player in the region. But there were more substantive speeches from people who were really sort of trying to stitch together what an American Orbanism would look like. So some of it was just ruffling feathers, but some of it was really saying, okay, which parts of this model actually could we import?
Now, you met a number of young American conservatives, including someone named Gavin Wax. Who is that?
Gavin Wax is in his 20s. He's the president of the New York Young Republican Club, which, you know, back in the day was a Reaganite, you know, sort of slightly country club Republican sort of vibe. And then after Trump, there was a kind of internal takeover, and Gavin and his friends made it a much more bellicose, Trumpy sort of thing. And they actually went out of their way to endorse both Trump and Viktor Orban for their reelection campaigns.
So I guess there's no mystery as to why Gavin Wax was invited to the Budapest session of CPAC.
Yeah. They tend to like people who, you know, give them warm, fuzzy press.
Yes, they invited us. They gave us a booth. They gave me a speaking slot. We met with the ambassador from Hungary in D.C. They invited us for a personal hour reception with him and his wife. So they have taken a keen interest in our club and what we're doing, what we're trying to build in terms of international.
Why has Hungary become the focus of the right? Why is the first CPAC happening here? Like, why here?
I think there's a few reasons. I mean, I think Hungary is, the government of Hungary is actively putting a lot of efforts to make sure that they become this sort of beacon of international conservatism. I think on the ground here, there's been a lot of success politically here in Hungary under the Orbán administration. That can't really be said about a lot of other countries, you know. And I think they've just done a very good job of reaching out to the American conservative movement that just simply hasn't been happening. In other countries in Europe or abroad. Maybe it's a cultural thing, maybe it's a language thing, I'm not exactly sure, but they've seized the moment, certainly.
Now, it seems to me shocking to see a full outward embrace by American conservatives, young American conservatives, of an authoritarian leader like Viktor Orban.
Yeah, it actually is shocking, and it should be shocking. But, of course, that's not how someone like Wax would see it.
That. I don't think this is an authoritarian country. I think it is a democratic country that elected a right-wing government, and some people don't like that they elected a right-wing government, a government that is governing in a right-wing fashion. But if you claim to be a supporter of democracy, or if you want to say you're a supporter of democracy with certain limits, then that's fine. I agree with you. But if he has violated those limits constitutionally, if he has violated limits in terms of his higher education policy, in terms of media policy, in terms of immigration policy, then I have disagreements with a lot of left-wing governments in many countries that violate those things. I'm not going to claim that those countries are non-democratic.
Boy, how prevalent is this argument that Hungary is merely run by a conservative right-wing government but is essentially democratic? How prevalent is that argument among American conservatives?
Yeah, you hear it all the time. This is just sour grapes. You know, the liberal world order is just mad that a conservative government is executing its agenda. And I have to say, Orban has played his hand extremely well because he does things so technically and so by the books and so methodically that you actually can't say he's broken the law. He has changed the law first and then done what he wants within the law that he has changed, right? But that's not technically illegal. It's not technically undemocratic, right? So you get into this weird semantic thing where you start to argue first principles and you can't actually point to anything he's done that's specifically unconstitutional. He just rewrote the Constitution.
Look, I think what's developing in a place like Hungary and in the U.S. is a sort of intellectual movement behind the Trump electoral win. I think Trump sort of won. He was kind of an idiosyncratic candidate. He was very unique. He was very different than what we've been used to. But there really wasn't a cohesive ideology behind him. But I do think that what's forming in a place like an event like this at CPAC Hungary and in other similar venues is a sort of, you know, codification of an ideology behind Trumpism, behind Orbanism, behind, you know, these right-wing populist movements, behind Brexit.
I think there was sort of a quiet consensus that Trump was a pretty feckless, lazy leader. You know, his heart may have been in the right place by their lights, but he didn't get things done. And so when you talk about American Orbanism, you're much more likely to hear people talk about Ron DeSantis, you know, maybe someone like J.D. Vance, maybe someone like Josh Hawley. In fact, Ron DeSantis apparently looks to Hungary as a legislative model. There has been some chatter that the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida was explicitly modeled on anti-gay legislation that was passed in Hungary the year before.
Did you leave Budapest with a different or new understanding of the American conservative movement?
Yeah, a more disquieting one, frankly. Because, you know, there is this constant debate over what is alarmism, what is hysteria, and what is real. And I couldn't really imagine, you know, a Putin-style takeover or a, you know, 1930s-style takeover. I mean, those are sort of outdated reference at this point. And so I could sort of comfort myself by saying, well, that's not a kind of thing that will probably happen here. But this kind of very technical, legalistic Orban model, I actually totally can see happening here. There are differences, but the similarities were pretty striking.
How would that happen? How would that work?
So some of it, you could argue, has already happened, right? You could imagine an extremely gerrymandered electoral map, which we clearly already have. Very sharp negative partisanship, very sharp polarization, people living in different epistemic universes. Then, you know, let's imagine that you want to change the courts without abolishing the courts, but you want to just deprive the opposition party of a chance to seat one of its nominees, and then you want to ram through your own nominees, right? That's something we've already seen happen. And again, you don't wake up one day and there's no Supreme Court. You just chip away at the institutional legitimacy. You know, again and again, I would talk to Hungarians and they would say, look, I don't want to alarm you, but it's not hard for me to imagine you being essentially at the top of the slippery slope that we were at 12 years ago. And in fact, one guy just said to me, you're looking at your worst nightmare.
Andrew Marantz, thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
Andrew Marantz is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he's the author of the book Antisocial, which is about extremism and the internet. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. So here's a little bit of TV trivia. What was the highest rated episode of any scripted TV series ever? And here's a clue. It aired almost 40 years ago. Pretty easy, right? The finale of MASH. Alan Alda directed that episode, and he starred as Hawkeye Pierce on the show during its 11-year run.
Whenever I see a big pair of feet or a cheesy mustache, I'll think of you.
Whenever I smell month-old socks, I'll think of you.
And the next time somebody nails my shoe to the floor.
Yeah, when somebody gives me a martini that tastes like lighter fluid.
But let's put nostalgia aside. Alan Alda has been extremely busy as an actor over the decades since MASH. He was in everything from The West Wing to 30 Rock, and he was in the recent film Marriage Story, playing a divorce lawyer for Adam Driver's character. He was also in a Tony Award-winning production of Glengarry Glen Ross, the David Mamet play, and more. Staff writer Michael Shulman, who covers arts and entertainment for The New Yorker, has watched Alan Alda's career evolve over the years.
The more I looked into his life story, there's so much breadth in what he's done. You know, he was a major activist in the feminist movement in the 70s. He created an institute at Stony Brook for helping scientists communicate. And he has this podcast, Clear and Vivid, now at 86, where he interviews scientists and politicians and artists and actors and all sorts of people. And he, you know, he really has this kind of ravenous, curious intellect, as well as being the Alan Alda that we all know and love from TV and movies.
Shulman sat down recently with Alda to talk about his life and his more recent role as an interview host on TV and on his podcast.
Do you have a kind of guiding philosophy for interviewing?
Yeah, I do. And it comes out of the hundreds of interviews I did on Scientific American Frontiers, the TV show on PBS. And that is to have as much as I can to have a genuine conversation, not ask them questions that I prepared in advance. But it should come out of curiosity, genuine curiosity, because that opens the other person up. I realized when I was doing Scientific American Frontiers that I was making use of things I had learned as an improviser and as an actor.
Do you have an example of that, of how improvisation has helped you communicate with people who have nothing to do with acting?
Improvising requires relating. I'm not talking about comedy improvising. I'm talking about improvising based on the work of Viola Spolin. She made a real contribution to theater in the country and acting. And you have to relate to the other person. You have to observe the other person. You have to be watching their face, their body language, because from that you find out what they're saying really means. And if you're paying that kind of attention, you're not worried about how you're doing so much. And when I would be talking to the scientists on the science show, took them out of lecture mode and put them in conversational mode.
Well, I do want to ask you about helping scientists communicate, because that's obviously a real passion of yours. Were you seeing a problem with scientists that you wanted to help solve?
It didn't occur to me that there was a problem to be solved. What occurred to me was if we trained scientists starting from actually improvising, if they would be able to relate to the audience the way they were relating to me.
Can you give me an example of an improv exercise that you did with scientists and what it helped teach them?
One of the most basic things for me is the mirror exercise. Let you and I do it. You be my mirror.
Does it work on Zoom?
Yeah, well, there's a little bit of a lag on Zoom, so it's not that easy.
Okay.
You're my mirror. It's just like the Harpo Marx mirror. No matter what I do, you have to instantaneously do the same thing. There's no echo. Now, did you see what just happened there? What happened? Why weren't you able to keep up with me?
Was I not concentrating?
No, because I went too fast. And what you learn when you do this is it's your responsibility to help the other person be the mirror. You're helped to learn how to pay attention to the other person and to recognize that it's your job to help them follow you.
I was reading your first book, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed, and there was a line that I really liked. You write, "I was curious from the first moments, not as a pastime, but as a way to survive." Can you explain kind of what you meant by that?
I don't know the whole context, but it probably has something to do with the fact that my mother, unfortunately, was schizophrenic and paranoid. And I had to decode her reality to figure out what actual reality was. She would see things that weren't there. She'd assume people she was being spied on. And I remember from a very early age noticing her depression and wondering what it was all about. I mean, like 4 or 5. And I was curious, but I think I was maybe a little extra curious because I had to figure out what was happening. What did people mean when they said things, especially her?
You know, your childhood is so different than what I think people might assume. You know, you've always had this kind of decency and goodness that you radiate as an actor. But in your book, you describe your father working in these seedy burlesque nightclubs and he and his friends shooting craps. And I just think that's so different than how people might imagine Alan Alda as a child.
Well, it's not the polar opposite of being decent. There was no indecency that I was aware of, just a lot of nakedity.
Nakedity?
And a lot of laughing and a lot of joking. As you know from reading that book, I was in the wings watching burlesque shows from the time I was 2 or 2.5. And I was very aware of the naked women, but I was also aware of the comics, and I watched their sketches, and sometimes as a joke, they put me in the sketch, this little kid. I think that's how I learned about the theater. That's how I learned acting, is from watching on the side.
Well, I learned from reading the book that your father was the original Sky Masterson in Guys and Dolls on Broadway, which is incredible.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight.
Yeah, stood in the wings and watched that every Saturday, two shows. Luck be a lady tonight.
So how old were you?
I was about 15, 16. How nice a dame you
can be. I mean, Guys and Dolls, I have to tell you, I was in Guys and Dolls in high school. I was Harry the Horse. So I would love to hear about that original production. What did you learn watching from the wings? What did you observe?
First of all, I knew my father so well. I could see how he used himself in his playing that character. The difference between him and the character was instructional to me. And even better than that was watching Sam Levine, who was a very spontaneous actor, and I really value spontaneity, say the exact same words every night, standing in the same place, but it would come out of him differently every night, to such an extent that he would sometimes get a laugh in a different place tonight from where it came last night. That's really unusual.
He was Nathan Detroit?
Yeah.
That's the part I wanted, but didn't get.
That's a great part.
Did you want to be the kind of actor that your father was?
No, I didn't want to. Interestingly, I was always more competitive with my father than he was with me. He was very gentle with me and thoughtful and almost never tough on me.
Did you ever completely slip up and forget a line on stage?
Well, everybody does once in a while, but I loved improvising so much as a young actor. I would just love it if somebody forgot to make an entrance, which has happened. And you're on stage all by yourself. Now the play belongs to you. Whatever you say or don't say or whatever you do, that's the play.
So one of your breakout roles in the 60s was in The Owl and the Pussycat on Broadway, this comedy about an aspiring novelist and his neighbor who's a prostitute, played by Diana Sands. I'd love to hear about that experience. Was it fun?
It was fun. It was an interesting experience rehearsing that. We rehearsed only for 3 weeks, and the director, who was Arthur Storch, had us reading at the table for more than 2 weeks. We never got up. And when we did get up, he said, put the script down and play the script as much as you can remember it and move wherever you feel like moving. It was almost an improvisation. What was interesting about that was we weren't learning the words so much as we were learning the intentions. We were learning what was happening. We were learning the emotions, and the exact words to put that in that the author had chosen could come later. But first you had the impulses. So there was a lot of energy in the show that you get when you arrive at something through improvisation. So I really enjoyed that very much. Dan and I were a little competitive with each other. It was only a two-character play, and each one of us was trying to take the stage away from the other. And the result of that was we were watching each other like hawks, and we got a lot of praise for ensemble acting, when what we were doing was the opposite of ensemble acting.
And then you were in the Broadway musical The Apple Tree, directed by Mike Nichols. What about his direction stuck in your mind?
You know, it's funny. It comes right on the heels of what we just were talking about. Barbara Harris and I were rehearsing a scene, and Mike said, you know, you're not relating to each other much at all. He said, you kids think relating is the icing on the cake. It's the cake. And that put into words what I was learning, and that has sort of become foundational for me, not just in my work as an actor, but and all this other stuff we've been talking about, the podcast, communicating all kinds of things.
Yeah, you know, it sounds easy to be spontaneous, but it's probably the hardest thing in the world.
I think you can see when you watch acting into which not a lot of time has been able to be put, and people are pretty much getting their lines out. Whereas in life and in exciting theater, people don't talk, don't behave, rather. People don't behave in a certain way without being made to behave that way by the other people or by the drive that's in them that's forcing them to do certain things. Usually it's you're ignited by the other person, not because it's in the script. You see it a lot in the procedural police television shows where, you know, they got to get 12 close-ups of 12 people in a room. And they're saying things like, maybe he did it at 4 o'clock. No, the freeway was closed at 4 o'clock. Maybe he did it at 3 o'clock. And they're not really talking to one another. They're saying it because it's on the page.
Well, you, of course, played the same character, Hawkeye, on MASH for 11 years. I'm curious, was it difficult over that incredible span of time to maintain the level of freshness and spontaneity that you're talking about?
I think there were probably dips. One of the ways, the process we developed off camera while we were waiting to do the shots, you know, you have to wait while they light the set, sometimes an hour, 2 hours. And instead of going back to our dressing rooms, most of the time we sat around in a circle of chairs and made fun of each other. And that laughing together, stories, just relating to one another, having a little party, a little get-together, gave us a connection that when they called us to the set, we still had, and we just continued it into the scene, but using the dialogue of the scene.
While you're writing, make note of the fact that thanks to the failure of the world's various elected heads, not to mention just plain dictators, to keep a cold war from turning hot, I am forced to operate alongside a surgeon who can't trim his toenails without committing malpractice.
I resent that. How do you know he meant you?
Sometimes we would keep talking while they were calling for quiet on the set through the clapperboard. And just before the first line of dialogue, we'd get quiet. I remember one or two times where that actually happened. And it sounds undisciplined, but it was a discipline of a different kind. We were keeping the connection going.
Well, what you're describing sounds a lot like the camaraderie of the characters in the show. You know, these are doctors working in a really dangerous, uncertain environment, and all they really have is each other's company.
Yeah, and there were nothing was, I'm sure that none of us ever experienced anything like what the people in real MASH units had to go through. But we had long days that were exhausting. 12-hour days was common, sometimes 14-hour days.
Alan Alda, the actor and interview host on television and podcasting. He's speaking with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman, and we'll continue with him in a moment. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Welcome back. I'm David Remnick. Recently, our staff writer Michael Shulman spoke with Alan Alda. Alda became a household name as a star of MASH, a hugely popular show about an American hospital operating near the front lines during the Korean War. But the show premiered during the fighting in Vietnam, and it struck a broadly pacifist tone that affected how a lot of Americans were seeing that war. Here's The New Yorker's Michael Shulman with Alan Alda.
I was curious thinking about MASH. You know, we've seen so many images over the last year of war, of really horrible atrocity, whether in Afghanistan or Ukraine. And I was curious if you feel like your experience doing MASH has affected how you think about those images and think about war in general.
I don't think so. I think I started out having really negative opinions about war. You know, as a little boy during World War II, watching war movies, I had a piece of cardboard with the silhouettes of American planes and Japanese planes, and I would always watch the skies to see if we were being invaded by Japanese pilots. And we played war games in the backyards. And as I got older and I got to think about what it would be like to kill somebody or get shot at myself, I developed a real distaste for it.
Yeah, I mean, MASH was so brilliant at combining the terror of war and comedy. And it makes me think a bit about Vladimir Zelensky, who, of course, was a sitcom actor and is now the president of a country at war and has been praised as an incredible communicator. What have you observed about him?
I watched his show and I was really interested to see what an amazing experience it was to watch the show where a high school teacher becomes a president, the president of a country. And then the guy who plays that part becomes the president of the country, almost mirroring the story of the satirical play. But the other experience was looking at modern, beautiful cities that now are in rubble and wondering how many of the cast are either afraid for their lives or maybe already dead. I never had an experience watching an entertainment like that.
On a completely different note, I wanted to ask you about your involvement in Free to Be You and Me in the 70s, which was, of course, this children's album and TV special created by Marlo Thomas. And it's such an incredible project because children are still bombarded with so much, you know, gender stereotyping. And it told people that they really don't have to follow those conventions. But why was that important to you at the time?
Well, I was a very vocal feminist, mainly in the effort to get the Equal Rights Amendment passed. And I spent about 10 years really devoting most of my time to that when I wasn't shooting or writing.
Yeah, weren't you called an honorary woman?
I kind of regret that because menopause was horrible.
But you'll live longer.
That's true. I never thought of it that way.
I mean, I can't think of very many other major public figures who are men who went out of their way to identify themselves as feminists. I mean, what kind of reaction did you get at the time?
I think at first, Phil Donahue, by the way, was very active. I think at first nobody minded it. It was sort of a curiosity that a man was speaking out about feminism. But to me, it seemed like fairness to both sexes, beneficial to both sexes. Why take half the population for any reason and tell them they're not entitled to participate in the culture? Then there was a reaction against it, that it didn't seem manly enough, or it was wimpy or something like that. But and stuff like that goes away.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There's so much talk now about how to be a good ally, whether to women or people of color. And I think people are still really trying to grapple with how to be a good ally. But it seems like you saw the value in that really early.
Yeah, and it was welcomed, and I was glad. I was glad to be able to help in whatever way I could. I think accepting the help of allies is a good idea, as long as the allies are sincere and get the point, which is not always that easy to do. And the people on the ground tend to understand what's needed more than the people in the tower. So you really have to be willing to listen if you want to be an ally.
Yeah, the feminist movement of the 70s was so foundational. And with this whole Supreme Court opinion on Roe v. Wade, it just feels like that era has been betrayed in some huge way, and that 50 years later, it's slipping backwards so much. How do you feel about what's been happening right now?
I think it's awful, and it's not clear that it's going to stop here.
What do you think that the role of men should be now in this fight for reproductive rights?
Personal outrage and encouragement of the outrage of the women around them.
Can I also ask you about, a few years ago you revealed that you have Parkinson's disease. How are you doing?
Surprisingly well. It was 7 years ago that I was diagnosed. And I have a tremor, which means that I can play any character as long as it has a tremor. So that's okay.
So, I mean, given your interest in science, has the science of Parkinson's disease interested you at all? I mean, do you look at it that way? Like, what's happening with my nervous system? What's happening with my body? Does that give you any sort of comfort, or is that an area of interest for you as you deal with it personally?
One of the things that I wish people knew more about was when you first get diagnosed, it's really important to do a Parkinson's-based therapy, physical therapy, right away. As soon as possible. It's interesting. I really wanted to know if I had it. I read an article by Jane Brody in the Times that talked about people who acted out their dreams often turned out to have Parkinson's. And I had had a couple of experiences like that. In one case, they're usually violent dreams. I was being attacked by somebody and I threw a sack of potatoes at them to fend them off. And in reality, what I was doing was throwing a pillow at my wife, Arlene. That kind of acting out of your dream can be an early symptom. Not so well known.
So was that one of the first things that you noticed?
Yeah.
Wow.
I went to a neurologist and said, I'd like to take a scan to see if I have Parkinson's. And he gave me a routine physical examination and said, you can have the scan if you want, but I'm telling you, you don't show any signs of Parkinson's.
Hmm.
Took the scan and he called me up and he said, boy, you really got it.
Oh my gosh.
But that's good. That gave me a chance to start doing something about it.
Has having Parkinson's changed your sense of what you want to do with your work?
I don't think so. I think it limits what I can do to some extent. So my job is to find out how I can get the most done within the limits that are set for me.
Hmm.
But I'm just pragmatic about it. I think of it as a part-time job.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me, Alan. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. And thank you for a fun conversation. I appreciate it.
The New Yorker's Michael Shulman spoke with Alan Alda. There's more from their conversation at newyorker.com. Thanks for joining us this week. And just one last thing. It's the end of June, and if you're still desperately looking for something for your kids to do, here's a helpful tip, courtesy of Emily Flake and Sarah Hutto.
Are you sick of going to camp without horses? Are you tired of experiencing a horse-free summer doing horseless activities? What if we told you that your days could be horse-filled?
I love horses.
Well, then come to horse camp. Here at Horse Camp, you'll start off every day in our communal horse tent, where we open our morning with a meditation. Next to horses!
That sounds kind of cool. And then we go horseback riding?
After our horse side meditation, we enjoy a fun-filled morning of arts and horse crafts.
Oh, so we, like, make crafts having to do with horses?
No, we set up craft tables for campers adjacent to a craft table for the horses.
Are you saying the horses actually do the crafts?
Not at all. Mostly they just eat the paste and knock the table over.
Oh, so then do we ride the horses?
After that, we go on a nature walk in the woods.
On the horses? We ride the horses in the woods, right?
We lure the horses into the woods with peanut butter, and then we just sort of let them roam around and trample the foliage.
When do we ride them, though?
Once one of our staffers did try to ride a horse, but they got kicked in the skull. So now we just hang out near the horses without mounting them.
Wait, what? What kind of horses are these?
Well, these are non-riding horses, feral horses that are hostile to human touch. But they are mostly tolerant of us being 20 feet or so away from them. No one has been fatally injured so far.
How did you even get these horses?
Ooh, the horses do not belong to us. Our camp is located nearby to, but definitely legally not on, the county's only dedicated wild horse preserve.
But I really want to ride and groom the horses.
Uh-huh. Next up, archery. Witness the majesty of the kind of stampede that only the use of flaming arrows can spark.
That sounds like animal abuse.
Then it's time for music hour. You've heard that music soothes the savage beast? Turns out it doesn't work on horses. But our stunning rendition of Wildfire does seem to lift human spirits.
Doesn't the horse in that song die?
Then a pony ride.
Wait, what?
We've contracted with a local riding stable for the use of one of their domesticated ponies. And by contracted with, we mean their staff goes home at the end of the day and the ponies are left unattended.
But won't the ponies be sleeping?
They're surprisingly easy to waken.
That seems like it would put them in a pretty bad mood.
What better time to bond with a horse than under the cloak of night?
Horses aren't nocturnal.
But they do sleep standing up. Plus, these are Shetlands. Easy to mount.
You can't ride a Shetland.
Not for long, no. Horse camp. Camp, but for doing stuff near horses.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. And we had original music this week by Alex Barron.
Horse Camp was written by Emily Flake and Sarah Hutto and performed by Dylan Dawson and Ava Briglia.
This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele, with help from Allison McAdam, David Gable, Harrison Keithline, Alex Barish, Victor Guan, and Mengfei Chen.
We had additional help this week from Michael May.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.